This is episode 76 of the Fifth Estate Podcast. Jay Nordlinger and Trump, year one. It is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. I'm Jay Caruso, along with my co-host, Mr. Jamie Otto. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, Jay. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right. It's kind of cold here lately. It was this morning when I left the house, it was like 15 degrees in Texas.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been a cold couple days. What's interesting, it's like as cold as it's been. Like yesterday, they were warning that there might be snow and all this other kind of stuff to worry about, and it didn't happen. But by Saturday, it's going to be like 65. So yeah,
I think you'll survive this.
I'll be all right. But I mean, I think it's a reminder of how I probably don't want to like move back to the Northeast or anything like that. I don't know. It was brutal cold. And we're talking like, you know, like it was like 5 with the wind chill yesterday. So it's like even a walk to the train station is just like, you know, really freezing. But you wouldn't know anything about it. You were in Southern California and now in the Pacific Northwest.
It's still pleasantly not that cold.
All right. So anyway, this is the part of the show where we talk about, you know, how wonderful we are and, you know, how we tell all of our listeners who are out there that, you know, to go and leave us a review on iTunes. You know, Amy's still relatively new here, so she wants to hear all those the good things that you're going to say about her.
You know, just all the feedback, please.
Yes, all the feedback. I don't think she's probably not as needy as Neil was for positive comments, but she likes it. I think it's everybody wants to hear positive stuff. You know, you actually had one. You know, there was. I think I told you. I don't know if we were last week or maybe I didn't tell you. It was just somebody said, you know, Neil is such a downer. Like, he's so much better.
Well, yeah. Neil slowly. Trump wore him down.
He certainly did. Speaking of Trump, good segue there. Today is the 18th, so within 3 days it'll officially be like one full year that Donald Trump was president. We survived. You know, I think a lot of people thought, you know, the world was going to end when he took office, and you know, it let's just say that it hasn't been boring. That's for damn sure. You know, that's why the year went by so fast, because it's certainly not something that, you know, was boring to people. But the fact that we got through a year, you know, and he got some stuff done and things happened. So we figured, you know, we should at the very least kind of, you know, kind of give an assessment. Well, how did he do? And looking at it from a, you know, a rational basis, not from a rabid kind of anti-Trump viewpoint. And not from a MAGA viewpoint, you know, because you know, if you're on the extreme ends of the spectrum, he is the greatest living greatest president who ever lived. And if you're on the other side, he's the Benedict Arnold of presidents and destroying democracy and all that other kind of stuff. So, you know, I wrote an article for the Dallas Morning News where I gave him a report card and he had grades A through F. On there, depending upon what it was. And so I you know, as much as I'm a Trump critic, I looked at it fairly. And so we brought on somebody else, our guest from National Review. We like people from National Review on the Fifth Estate. This would be the fourth National Review writer that would be on the Fifth Estate. And, you know, this is good for me because we share the same first name. My name is Jay, and Jay Nordlinger is here. From National Review. Jay, nice of you to join us.
I'll try not to be insulted. I'm number 4. I guess it's better than being number 5. Good.
So number, who will be, well, I guess we'll make David French will be number 5 if we can get David on here. So, you know.
I've never podcasted with another Jay before. I think I've podcasted with an Amy. But guys, what was that music at the beginning of the show?
That was that was Charlie Parker, KC Blues. It was actually written by Miles Davis.
So and could you tell me what the Fifth Estate is?
The Fifth Estate? What the Fifth Estate is kind of like what? It's a nickname. Are you talking about the podcast? Or what does it mean?
Yeah, where the name comes from. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Fifth Estate. You know, it unfortunately it can also be tied to that ridiculous movie about Julian Assange, which that was the title of it. But we had it first, where basically it's you know. Here, like, so the Wikipedia entry says Fifth Estate is a sociocultural reference to a groupings of outlier viewpoints in contemporary society and most associated with bloggers, journalists, publishing, and non-stream media outlets,
perfect
podcasts,
for us.
That kind of thing. What's that?
Perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect for us.
Yeah. It worked out well. And then that stupid movie came out. And well, actually, the movie came out first, but we didn't take it from that. Mm. So we don't associate with those people.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, no. Good.
I'm anti-Assange.
Yes. I think we're safe, on safe ground there. I don't think Amy's going to be turning around and say, wait a minute. Huh. I kind of like that guy. Yeah, but so
funny, I wonder if he's in the pay of the Russian government or whether he does it out of belief.
I don't know. It's kind of frustrating, though, when you see Donald Trump tweet something and then Julian Assange tweet something that's kind of like in the same ballpark, about, especially at the press or something like that. It's kind of depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the entire right was against Assange and WikiLeaks, that he had made American foreign policy very hard. He had made our wars harder. He was endangering the lives of people who were helping us in the field. And people on our general side were absolutely vitriolic against Assange, rightly so, I think.
Yeah, and Sean Hannity was one of them. He called him a traitor on
now
air.
Now Congressman Rohrabacher is pleading for a pardon for Assange.
Oh, my gosh. That's just terrible. So so leading this back to Donald Trump and what we talked about. Now, Jay, from what I've seen in your Twitter feed and what you've written, you're kind of like... Yeah, you're in the same kind of camp that I would think probably some of the other writers are, like Kevin and Jonah. You know, you're not a Trump supporter, but you're not just like reflexively anti-Trump with, you know, with anything that he does. But you're a pretty strong critic of Donald Trump, am I correct?
Yes. Well, Donald Trump has been in public life for a very long time, and he was famous when I was a kid, really. And I didn't exactly admire him, but you could get a kick out of him. You know, he's a heck of a showman, right? And he has an almost genius for self-promotion. I remember when he was on television saying that he wished he had tried to date Lady Di or Princess Di before she died, that sort of thing. He was a tabloid celebrity.
Right.
He's on the cover of the New York Post a lot. And when he started to run in 2016, I thought he was spectacularly unsuited to the presidency. I think he is. I think he's manifestly unfit in mind and character. But the American people disagreed. The Republican Party nominated him, and the people elected him through the Electoral College. And in a way, American democracy is a remarkable thing, that such a person has risen to the presidency. And I think our institutions are strong. I'm all the more impressed with our founding fathers, frankly, those good old framers who created this system. I think there's very little harm a President Trump can do domestically, almost none. It's just too hard. You know, our checks and balances are in place. We have a robust free press. But any president has a great deal of latitude in foreign policy, national security, the military. And there, I think there are some concerns. But as you said, it sure hasn't been boring. It makes me appreciate boring, even milquetoast, good Republican small R government.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would. You know, it's funny. Some people were saying, you know, well, you know, Trump's been kind of exciting. I said, well, you know what? Right around now, I'd probably want some boring. I was having lunch with Scott Linsicum, who's with the scholar at the Cato Institute. And we were talking about how Trump was kind of out of the picture during the Christmas vacation. He was just like, you know, wasn't around. He wasn't tweeting. You didn't hear much from him. And there was a lot of discussion going on about the GOP tax plan. And Scott was like, it was almost like things were normal. People were like discussing policy. And
yeah.
And it was like this return to an era which we had completely forgotten about. And, you know, and now we're two and a half weeks into January, and it's already, you know, just another continuation of the circus.
But this presidency seems to be the Donald Trump show. And what you said about wanting a more boring or normal government, that's a very conservative sentiment. Very conservative. Not so much as a matter of policy, as a matter of temperament, to have limited government doing its job, doing it competently. But in a country like ours, the president shouldn't be on stage every second, or as the old saying goes, the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral. You know, I could use a dose of Coolidge self-effacement at the moment. I felt the exact same way, of course, for the 8 years of Obama.
Yeah, I mean it. Yeah, it's well, you know, I mean, people don't want to admit it, but the Obama created a sense, you know, the what you'd call the celebrity type president. You know, constantly, you know, I don't see anything wrong with the president appearing on a you know, a late night show from time to time, but he always seemed like he was on with David Letterman or Jay Leno, or, you know, on The Daily Show, or and going to the extremes, appearing on, you know, with YouTube stars and things of that nature, and BuzzFeed videos. And so, you know, it became that kind of thing in a sense, you know, maybe not to the extreme that we're seeing it now, but it certainly laid somewhat of a groundwork there. And I think there's you know, I think part of it, and Amy, jump in here, you think that's true, is that, you know, one of Trump's things is that he just simply doesn't care what people think about him. And this comes from the kind of tabloid notion that Jay was talking about. Cause I grew up, you know, in New York and New Jersey, and I saw Donald Trump all over Page Six for 20 something years.
Affairs. He's a Howard Stern guest, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And, exactly.
Amy, I'm sure you're far too good a person to have listened to Howard Stern as I have. In fact, I listened to him for years.
I actually commuted earlier on in New Jersey, and there was nothing else to do but do that. So, yes.
So you know.
I don't know if I ever actually heard Remarkable. Trump on the show.
Yeah, me neither, frankly. Yeah, I only caught clips later.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it was weird. I remember watching the first season of The Apprentice, and at the time, being a project manager, I was actually mildly amused. And I liked Carol, the woman. It was like the old guy, like in the woman. I don't know what happened to her. She worked for him. Like, occasionally Trump does seem to hire bright women, which is an interesting feature of him. But he was horrible on the show, but it was complete entertainment. I mean, I never watched a season after like the first season, but like, that's my memory of that. And I mean, it was a sales pitch show, and it was this whole idea of like the business world could work this simply, which is actually absurd. Like, it doesn't actually work that way. Like, you don't just come back and report on a project, and the project manager is not the most important person in the company either, nor would they be getting FaceTime with the CEO. But it was entertaining. I mean, he was entertaining. It was silly. He made light of things, but he packaged up business in a way that on television with NBC that was appealing and entertaining for people. You can't fault him on that as far as those pieces, but it's not someone I imagined to be president either.
Well, and Amy, I was thinking yesterday, I think, that he hosted Saturday Night Live during the 2016 campaign, and there are all these skits about how he gilds the Washington Monument, right? And there's an actress playing Melania, and he turns to the camera and says, "Won't she make a great first lady," or something like that? And it seemed like such a joke, such a farce. And lo, Donald Trump is president, and Melania Trump is first lady. It is probably the strangest event in American political history. And maybe there's not a person in the country could have beaten through the Electoral College except Hillary Clinton. I don't know. We can't have a rerun, but it's one of the great what ifs.
The universe has a sense of humor.
Amazing.
If you were going to run Hillary, what would be the funniest way to beat her?
So what do you guys think of Oprah 2020?
Oh, no. You know, and it's funny. I saw the initial initial poll that they actually did, and she's only running like 2 points ahead of Trump. And I think people are like, well, maybe not. But then again, we don't know. In another year, in a year and a half, when the 2020, race kind of starts in earnest, who knows what'll happen?
Well, I often quoted Rick Brookhiser in previous years, a National Review colleague and historian, who said the presidency is not an entry-level political job unless you've won a war like Eisenhower. And yet Trump stepped into it. And it just makes you, when you look at Dwayne The Rock Johnson, all of a sudden he's more plausible. And we all thought it was weird when Jesse Ventura, the professional wrestler, was elected governor of Minnesota. But that was a governorship. And so when you say, hey, how about Kid Rock for senator from Michigan, I don't really chuckle anymore. I go, oh, that's interesting.
Well,
yeah. I kind of take the Oprah thing. I was like, I don't know. I walk through it. I'm like, she'd probably win. I don't know. I'm not going to fight it anymore. I refuse to predict that she wouldn't.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, being you know, it's
fight it anymore.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm still getting reminded every time about how I was wrong about, and I, okay, yeah, I was wrong. I know. I mean, you know, but I was also right. And I said that he would,
so was
he would do
everyone.
Such damage to the party and to the conservative movement. And we're seeing that unfolding before our very eyes. But let's
I don't know much about that.
Well, I mean, he's hurting.
I actually disagree, because I don't think Trump has anything to do with the conservative movement. I don't know. I mean, he's damaging the Republican Party as a brand. I think that's a different thing. I don't know if the conservative movement and the Republican Party were a brand that completely overlapped anyway.
Well, I mean, I agree with what Ben Sasse said. He said parties are just a vehicle to move certain things along. And it's just, I think it kind of goes hand in hand. I think he's just, everybody's saying now that Republicanism is Trumpism, and basically that, it's his party now. And now how long that lasts, I don't know. I mean, if the Democrats can field a respectable, decent candidate, and maybe they'll have to go with Oprah.
They have Chelsea Manning. Come on. They're really getting in the message here of like, the people are going to want a stable, normal person. I know Chelsea Manning.
Well, I think I find it amusing that she's running right now just attacking the Democratic Party. She's not even saying anything about Republicans. So they got like their own little, Tea Party faction to deal with, if you want to call it the Bernie faction, probably is what it represents at this point. Mm. But I mean, yeah, that's a scary discussion for another day. So let's go back. Let's turn back here a little bit to some of the things that Trump did over the last year. And one of in the piece that I wrote, the one A grade that I gave him was on the judiciary. Now, I don't think that he has any kind of knowledge about the people that he's been nominating to the federal bench, to the appeals courts. I don't think he knew anything about Neil Gorsuch.
Outsourced it to the Federal Society, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They handed him a piece of paper and he's just like, yeah, okay, this one doesn't matter. I don't think he cares.
Yeah.
But it's still been, I mean, aside from a couple of obviously manifestly Blunkers. Unqualified, things, it's been pretty good.
Absolutely. Better than pretty good. It's been sterling, I think, the judicial nominations. So much good can come, from the point of view of someone like me, so much good can come out of a Republican administration almost by accident. You know what I mean? You got your deregulation. You've got tax reform. You've got judicial nominations. You've got a certain robustness in defense, right? Great, if you're sort of Republican-minded, great good can come out of any Republican administration, and this is a Republican administration. Look at the cabinet alone. Betsy DeVos at Education and James Mattis at Defense and so on. And, Nikki Haley has been impressive at the UN, yes. And that's all to the good. But then it all, as the first George Bush used to say, it all comes down to the man at the desk. And some people on the right, they sort of want a Trump presidency without Trump. They want Ryan and McConnell to handle legislation. They want competent administrators to handle other matters, and Trump's a bit of a distraction with his tweets and so on. And yet the president is at the heart of it all, and he sets an example. And I know it's a terrible cliche to say that character is destiny, but it does matter. It matters for our reputation in the world. It matters for what young people think. I think it's important that the president tell the truth. And when Jimmy Carter campaigned in 1976, that was the first campaign I was really aware of. He said over and over, "I'll never lie to you." And people said it was gooey and kind of dumb. But after Watergate, a lot of people wanted it. And I'm still a social conservative. I don't think we should have presidents who lie routinely or who pay off porn stars or who are personally cruel and loudish. And I know that sounds very, very fogeyish today. You know, get off my lawn, grandpa, you know, kind of thing. But I think there are about three social conservatives left in the world, and I'm afraid I'm one of them.
No, well, the other Jay that's on this show with you is one of them as well. Yeah, because I think the same thing, and I always hear about, well, who cares, you know, if he's a louse and he's this and, you know, he, you know, is, you know, just mean and says nasty things and says, you know, sends stupid tweets, and everybody's like, you know, I hear a lot about, you know, I don't care because, you know, conservative policy is getting, conservative policy is getting implemented as a result. And I think that, and this is where I go back with Amy when I was talking about so much, not so much, you know, destroying the conservative movement, but one of the things that I believe that he's doing is that what I wrote is that, you know, with everything that's going on, you know, he's implementing conservative policy, but he's got approval ratings that are just, I think they just ticked above the 30s or like 41%. I said he's basically making these kinds of policies unpalatable to a lot of people because of his behavior. And if you don't think that that matters, it, you know, that's where, you know, some of the bad numbers come in, because if you, you know, everybody, you know, people may not credit him entirely with the economy and with the low unemployment and with the Dow Jones and everything, but it's, you know, presidents are still, they still share in that success. And I have told people, I said, if he stopped tweeting for a month, I think you'd see his approval ratings probably shoot up 10 points because there just wouldn't be any of the drama surrounding it.
Yeah, that is totally fair. I mean, I agree in that sense that I still, you know, I think I'm more maybe jaded at that point. Just maybe you're misinterpreting some of the, it's a pragmatist point of view, because the two people who were up there to be chosen from weren't that great. Yeah. Trump is pretty horrible and it's depressing, and the porn star story is just really, really pathetic. And it's funny that it's not even like the top story, you know.
It causes barely a ripple, which, Amy. It's amazing.
Which is strange, but yeah, I think because it's built into his brand, like it's expected. So people just are like, yeah, it's right. Trump. We already knew it was Trump.
Remember when our side freaked out when Obama put his feet on the desk in the Oval Office? But what a breach of decorum that was, and disrespect for the office and all this stuff. Cripe, it seems positively quaint.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's something about Trump being outside of politics there, where his brand is such that apparently is not surprising. I think because it's not surprising. Maybe that's why
exactly.
It's not a top story.
It's a new normal.
Yeah.
It's a lower standard. That's right. People expect it, so they shrug. A lot of people do. Yeah.
There's nothing you can do. But you're like, that's who he is. That's who he's told us he's been. And that's what we're stuck with. And I do believe it will. I think like the recent special election in Wisconsin and a lot of the other ones, I think there's hints of it. But I think it's, in some ways, I feel like Trump is going to do what Obama did to the Democrats down ticket in the state legislatures. Mm. It may not be, he might even be crazy enough to win re-election, but I think you're going to see immense backlash at the state level. And other places where all those gains that made in the past 8 years for Republicans everywhere else, where Obama kept his spot but degraded everything underneath him, I suspect we're going to see something similar, and it's just going to go the other way.
I wonder if young people, what do I mean by young, people now in their teens, maybe 20s, I wonder if for a long time to come they'll associate the Republican Party and conservative political views with Trump and Trumpism. I don't know. I'm a Reagan baby myself. So I That's the way I think. But I wonder if Trump will be stamped on the GOP and on conservatism.
I think they'll try. There's no doubt the Democrats are trying to make make the Republican Party live with this. I don't know how long. It could be two generations. They may keep bringing this up, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it sticks necessarily because he is in the same, like his positives or the way he wins in certain races also isn't transferable. It's like no one else can be Trump. Like when Ed Gillespie in Virginia tried, it's a weird non-transferable thing because he's kind of outside of it. But
he just didn't seem like he liked Confederate monuments that much, you know. And it didn't seem like he opposed immigration that much. Yeah, there's a certain authenticity. Probably, I see what you mean.
It just seems that Trump is Trump. He's tacitly associated with the Republican Party. I don't know if the Republican Party could ever live it down in that sense, but they probably, if they were any good at branding, could start to deviate and separate their brand depending on what candidates come next.
Can't really disagree with that. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. And we are going to hear from our friends at Quip, and then we'll be back with Jay Nordlier. Hello, Fifth Estate fans. Jay Caruso here to talk to you about the Quip toothbrush. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. I own one of these toothbrushes. I love it. They're lightweight. They work very well. I love the toothpaste that they send along with it. It's terrific. So what is Quip? Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of bulkier traditional electric toothbrushes. Guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's in your gym bag or carry-on. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5. And that includes free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of the Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. And find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/fifth, F-I-F-T-H, right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/fifth. Spelled out, that is getquip.com/fifth. And we are back. So kind of going back to what we were talking about just a moment before we took the break, even here in Texas, where, you know, this is the thing about the Democratic Party. If they weren't so inept themselves, they'd be in better position. But, you know, and they're just as inept here in Texas as they are in other areas of the country. But, you know, we are interviewing. There are just like so many people running in primary races where they'll be running in a general election campaign against Republicans who didn't win by very big margins last time around. So now you've had a lot of people jumping in who may not have bothered just 2 years ago, but now they're saying, okay, we think that this Republican is vulnerable. Let's see if we can get somebody new in here and a Democrat rather than having somebody who has, you know, been there for 10, 12 years. And so it's like, we're seeing, you know, for a race that maybe 2 years ago, there wouldn't have been a primary challenger. Four people will be trying to vie for this particular, you know, House seat, you know, Texas House seat. Mm. And so those vulnerabilities are there. And so we're seeing that, and we witnessed a little bit of that in Wisconsin. I don't think, everybody wants to point to Alabama as some kind of bellwether, but I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, we know why Roy Moore lost.
So anomalous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And he only lost by 10,000 votes. I mean, if Luther Strange, was the nominee, it would have been a blowout. So I don't think that really counts. You can't look to Alabama for anything, but you can see some of these other areas where, you know, people are nervous. And I don't, and I've said this before, I don't think I don't think that Republicans will lose the Senate because I think this, you know, I think Democrats have 23 seats or something like that they have to defend. Republicans have 8. But the House, you know, it's 25 net is all the Democrats need. And
yeah, there are a lot of Republican retirements, aren't there?
A lot, a lot. And I think there's been like 5 in Texas alone. Now, they're in, some of those were in safe districts. I don't think they're going to flip to Democrats. But there's also been some that are in some, in, you know, Daryl Issa is not going to run for re-election in his district, which is, you know, he didn't win very big the last time around. So these are all, there are a number of races. Jay Koss, as a matter of fact, I think for National Review wrote a very good piece analyzing that. And his concern is about the House as well. And that'll be interesting to see how Trump works then. If, you know, he thinks dealing with Paul Ryan is difficult.
I never thought that Nancy Pelosi would be speaker again. It seems impossible that she will be, right? When she was speaker the first time, I thought it was, you know, Armageddon, because I never liked her kind of politics at all and still don't. But she seems to me basically a figure of the past. So it might take me a while to wrap my mind around the idea that she will again be speaker. I think she's been in politics my whole life.
Yeah, she's been around for a long time. I know Tim Ryan has been of Ohio, has been one that has kind of stepped up to try and, you know, challenge her. Maybe not so much on that level in terms of like challenging her for speakership, but certainly saying, you know, trying to say, let's pull the party in a different direction.
Well, that'll keep the speaker named Ryan. I mean, there you go.
Fine. Do you guys think that Paul Ryan will remain in the House if Republicans lose the majority?
No.
No.
I think he hinted at, you know, there was that hint around his retiring, and I think, what is he going to do? He's going to go back to being, you know, the budget committee chairman or something like that,
or the ranking member. Once they've seen the lights of Perry, it's hard to keep him down on the farm. I mean, it'd be kind of a come down, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you're Speaker of the House, and now all of a sudden you're not even going to be a ranking. You're only going to be a ranking member on a committee somewhere in the hopes that maybe 2 years from now you'd reverse the situation. And even then, with, you know, with the House Freedom Caucus and with a lot of that thing, would you even get to be speaker again, or would he even want to be speaker? I don't think he necessarily wanted to do it, you know, the first time around. John Boehner got a raw deal for how he was treated as Speaker of the House, but that was something that was good for him. That kind of politicking is what he needed. Whereas Ryan is a policy guy.
Yeah.
He's not the political guy.
He's a think tanker in politics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I hate to invoke the name of Dennis Hastert considering what we know about him now, but he was somebody who was an effective speaker that, you know, wasn't a policy guy. He was more behind the scenes political guy. It's a very tricky, you know, very tricky thing. I think people probably watch too much House of Cards to think it's a little too outrageous, but
yeah.
I just don't think Ryan seemed to be somebody who was up for that role. I think he took it more because it was like people said, we need you to take it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. How do you see it?
Well, I very much wanted him to be vice president. I would have liked to see a Romney Ryan administration. I think it would have been just the right thing at the right time. I guess we'll never know. I always admired Ryan quite a bit. He represents the kind of conservatism, kind of a modern American conservatism, Reaganite, Kempite conservatism that I myself favor.
Yes, me too.
And I think he's a thoroughly decent person. And so I admire him. To my taste, he's been far too accommodating of Trump. But I understand, too, that he's in a ticklish spot, as we'd say in my native Midwest, in his native Midwest. And I suppose politicians have responsibilities and considerations that people like me don't. And so I try to cut him some slack. But I must say that at my age in particular, and after all we've seen, I should really stop falling in love with politicians. I had this weakness my whole life of falling in love with certain politicians. And it's probably unwise. It's probably unwise in this fallen world. I remember I was talking with the aforementioned Rick Burkheiser about this in a podcast some months ago. And I said, what do you think of Ben Sasse? And I said it with a kind of spring in my voice, right? And he said, you know, the last politician I fell in love with was Giuliani, because Rick Burkhizer is very much a New Yorker. He said, now I'm pretty much done with it. You know, he'll have a skepticism from now on. And I'm a real fanboy of Sass. You know, put not your faith in princes, right? I remember probably my favorite politician in America was Henry Hyde, the congressman from Illinois. Mm-hmm. He was so well-rounded, so smart, so judicious, so articulate. And then some news came out about him, which was very unpleasant. And the bloom was off the rose. And I remember a colleague of mine kind of mocked me for this, for being a big prude and, you know, for being a dinosaur and caring about stuff like that. But my answer was, we all get to pick what we admire and what we disdain, you know, what we value, what we like to emphasize. And no one can decide for anyone else. It's really quite personal. It's like voting. I always say you go into the booth. This is very old-fashioned. But you go into the booth and you close the curtain behind you and you pull the lever for Smith or Jones. And you may have your very own reasons and you don't even tell anyone about it even. And I guess I have to at last accept that people simply have different values and different expectations from politicians. And a great many people on my readers of mine, or fans or former fans of mine, frankly, have said about Trump, I don't care whether he lies. He drives the left crazy. I'm drinking liberal tears. I like the judicial nominations. I hate the media. I don't care whether he lies. And that's a choice.
Yeah, it's... Thanks, Jay. We're all depressed now.
Sorry to sermonize.
That's depressing.
Business and the persuasion business. But I've sort of given up on it. People value what they value, and they like what they like, and it's a very hard thing to argue about. We all see the same guy, Trump, but we see different guys. And there's a gap between those who think he's fit in mind and character to be president and those who don't. And I don't know how to bridge it. Dear friends of mine, bosom friends of mine, are wildly pro-Trump. They practically live in red hats, you guys. And these are the people I've always loved. And we see things completely differently. And I find myself sort of sputtering, not really knowing what to say.
Yeah, it is funny, you know, because you know, you see that in, like, you know, especially if Donald Trump was a Democrat, does anybody honestly think that Jerry Falwell Jr. would just sit there and embrace the guy, you know, and Pastor was Jeffress here down in Houston, you know, saying, hey, with after the shithole comments, hey, you know, I mean. I don't want him talking that way, but he's, you know, the sentiment is actually kind of true, and so, you know, it's good that he's strong on those issues, and it's this kind of bend over backwards kind of thing where it's like, well, you know, I don't really care, like you just said, Jay, it's like, I don't care what he says, I don't care how he says it, I don't care. He's doing what we want to do, so what difference does it make if he's you know, if that's where it's, you know, if he's doing something that's more conservative than George W. Bush, who cares if he's...
Sure.
Yeah, who cares if he's, you know, just a moral degenerate.
Yeah. I must say it's a very hard thing to swallow, all this hypocrisy. We didn't like it when people lied to the FBI, right? As Mike Flynn did. Remember all the comments about Obama's gaffe? You know, that's gone now. Remember how we faulted the Obama family for all of that executive travel and the burden on the taxpayer? All sorts of things. We used to count the number of times Obama said I and me in a speech. We used to mock him for it, mm-hmm. right? We used to mock him as arrogant, right? And I hate to think there's no principle involved, but I just see that the tribalism is so strong. It's a matter of red jerseys and blue jerseys. Our team and their team. And sometimes principle seems to have very, very little to do with it. I mean, imagine if one of their guys, if a Democratic politician said when you remember when Bill O'Reilly said to Trump, but Putin's a killer. And Trump said, well, you think our country's so innocent? Imagine if a Democrat had said that. Mm. We'd have gone stark raving nuts. I certainly would have.
It was bad enough when he said it.
Yeah, that's when yeah.
So I was like, see, I didn't want to really sit through a year of Trump because you're going to make me remember all this stuff.
You know, it hasn't
like really that's what we're talking about. I was trying to block it out.
It hasn't even been a year. We could have 3 more years, 7 more years.
Well, look at it this way.
Just begun, as the song says.
Yeah, look at it this way. It's been almost 3 years. Three. Since Donald Trump said what he did about John McCain, about him not being a hero, and he was only a hero because he was cat. He said that in July of 2015. So in July, it'll be 3 years since he uttered those words. So we've been dealing with this for nearly 3 years, ever since he announced. You know, it's only been 1 year as president, but, you know, that was, I mean, and Jay, that kind of goes back to that. It was all this stuff like saying everybody thought, okay, now he's gone too far. Now he's gone too far, and you check the polls, and he's still there, and it's just like, and he's winning. Then he'd start winning, you know, not winning like huge, but you know, I mean, I think when he crossed the threshold of the electors he needed, not electors, I should say, but the primary votes, and I think he was at like 35%. It wasn't a large margin or anything like that, but. We just saw what was going to happen, and then you know, everybody assumed no, there isn't a person alive that thought that maybe a couple of people who thought he was absolutely going to win, but most people were shocked, even supporters were shocked that he pulled it off. So I mean, it's just you know, then everything has been like I said, you know, Amy just said for a year it's just been crazy. You know, you go back to his. You know, when you talk about moral authority, and then you look at his response, say after Charlottesville. Which was just, it was horrendous. I mean, very fine people, you know, and just, you know, and then of course there's the defiance, it, you know, it's the inability to say that he was wrong or that he didn't do something right. He doubles down, insists he was right, changes his statement to placate whoever tells him, Mr. President, you can't say that kind of thing. But then goes back and says, no, what I said originally was perfectly fine, but you know, the fake news was on me, so I had to say something else. And it's just the and what I guess what bugs me is I expect from the hardcore Trump people who were with him from the moment he came down to the escalator, I can understand when they defend him on this, but it's like when there are, again, we have conservatives who wrote columns for 8 years. Just dismayed at the moral decay that Barack Obama brought to the United States, who now turn around and shrug their shoulders and say, I don't care. You know, the rules are different now.
Well, but Bill Clinton is even more analogous, frankly. Yeah. I see in some respects a replay of the 1990s, the late 1990s, the attacks on the special counsel. It all seems very familiar to me. But with people on different sides.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. And I think what's unfortunate, and I don't know if Amy will agree with this or not, but the extremes make it hard for people to kind of take a nuanced view. Like, you know, Jay talked about, you think his judicial choices have been great. And so if you say that, then you're accused of being an enabler or something, you know, they're saying that people can't be really opposed to Trump like Ben Sasse if they're going to go and vote for his tax cut. Well, what, you know, would they still,
it's Sasse, really a Republican tax cut.
It's, yeah. Exactly. They still have constituents that they have to answer to. And if their constituents are saying, you know, writing them letters and sending emails saying, yeah, we want this tax cut bill passed. I mean, you could vote against it, but if you come back to your constituents and say, well, the reason why I voted against it is because Trump is a bad guy.
This doesn't make any sense. That's not how you should vote on legislation.
Exactly.
On a tax cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just silly. I mean, I wrote an article yesterday that was posted. It was just very simple about how moms on the left and right actually want their daughters to be treated better. And people are like, this is crap. The left is a monster. They don't believe that. I'm like, there's no way to have conversations outside of political parties, it feels like, anymore. And that's that. I don't know. I find that a little depressing. Like, there can't be rational thought implemented. Of course, Ben Sasse is going to vote for a Republican tax cut. That has nothing to do with Trump. That's been a longstanding thing. And I mean, and obviously, I don't know if you're going to grade something good out of the Trump administration or of this year, the corporate tax cuts a very good outcome, making
very
us
helpful.
Competitive
yes.
again. I mean, all it does is make our tax rate in line and competitive again, and it's bringing a lot of money back overseas, and it is going to do a lot of good. So maybe sometimes, I don't know, for the small wins, that there are real Americans whose lives are going to get better because of that, because there will be more jobs because of it. Those are good things.
Can I ask you guys something about the media? Mm-hmm. Obama said something to David Letterman the other day. He didn't put it quite the way I do, but he said something that I've said and others have said for many years. He said, one of the problems we have is that we don't have a common set of facts. We all read different things. We live on different planets. So people who watch Fox News live on a different planet from people who listen to NPR. And it's very hard to have a debate if we're not working from common news or a common understanding. You have to have facts before you have opinions, right? And I think that's true. And I just it seems to me that people are in their own media worlds. And I like to ask people what they read or watch to keep informed. Mainly sometimes I like the advice. And I wonder if I could ask you two what you read or watch. Do you go left and right, or do you have something you think of as relatively straight? What do you do?
Well, I read. So I'm actually one of those subscribers to the actual newspaper Wall Street Journal. I get the print edition delivered, so I read that every day. Obviously, the news side of the paper is far different from the editorial side, but it's interesting. But and sometimes I really agree with the editorial board. I think they hit the nail on the head, and other times I'm just kind of like, stop. But that's you're going to have that view for an editorial
sure.
board. I read the New York Times. I chuckle a lot when I read their editorials because they're seemingly so unhinged at times. I think I am not one of these fake news type people, so I will read all different types of things. I'll read the Washington
yeah.
Post. I will from time to time read something at, say, Mother Jones. I tend to stay away from or Talking Points Memo. I'll read something there. I tend to stay away from The Nation and Media Matters and super like partisan left wing sites. Same way people probably won't read Breitbart. Now, I don't read Breitbart. I won't read mm-hmm. Gateway Pundit. I, of course, naturally read National Review and the Weekly Standard. You know, I my goal is to kind of take in as much as I can. I avoid cable news for the most part. I think it's a show like this, a podcast is, and I think there's a reason why podcasts are exploding is because people want to listen to something that's a little bit more in depth rather than, you know, 5 minutes of sound bites. It was interesting. We had
not me.
No, that was me. Sorry. We had James Rosen on this show prepared to talk about his book, you know, that he edited, you know, the Buckley book, Torch Well Lit.
Yeah.
And at first he started to go into, you know, just kind of like the standard responses that you would have if he was on a 10-minute spot.
Sure.
And by the end of the show, he was like, oh, can I tell you another story about, you know, Bill Buckley? Yeah, go ahead. You know, and so that was that kind of thing. And so cable news, I generally avoid. There are a few people that I will watch. I'll watch Dana Perino's show. I think she's a pro. And I'll watch Jake Tapper. And sometimes I'll watch Morning Joe just to see how laughably self-righteous they are. And when I think back 2 years ago, how much they would giggle and snicker whenever Donald Trump was on the show. And you know, the stuff that they sit there, oh no, that they shudder about now that they thought was hilarious back then. So it's, yeah. Anyway, so as much as I possibly can, really, to kind of get a full picture of what it is. And since I'm a writer, I want to be able to do that. So I'm just a little bit more informed. So maybe I'm one of those crazy people that reads a ton of stuff.
That's a good way to be. Are you the same way, Amy, more or less?
Yeah, I mean, I use Twitter as an index for reading whatever the latest news are. But I mean, to be honest, my mix of feed is very mixed. So, you know, I'm reading either Bloomberg, a lot of Business Insider, Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post,
wow.
NRO.
Read
I read more. I end up actually, and then, well, and plus my feed has, you know, for writing more about culture and things like that. I'll have New York Magazine, other stuff, just other culture pieces. Like, I end up having to follow women's magazines sometimes for things I write, for ideas. But I don't watch cable news at all. I actually, in any form, I might be forced to watch a clip if someone shared it to be like, okay, how terrible is this, just for my own, but it's like for entertainment. I don't get news out of it. You're just like, it's not informative. Yeah. And I don't have, well, I mean, I have three kids. I don't have time to sit and watch the news, nor do I want to explain it to them either, because it's often yelling and screaming. And then I don't know how to explain it to kids, because it's like, okay, they'll be like, what's going on? I'm like, actually nothing. Nothing is being resolved here. So, so I don't watch it for that reason either. But yeah, it's more reading long form, short form. Sometimes a podcast topic will interest me. I read Vanity Fair, like for movies and culture, those kind of things. And it's interesting because following them on Twitter, they're often very left wing feeds. But you know, I still love their writing when they write about movies or culture. So
yeah, sure.
You kind of end up doing those things. So I consume it that way. I have to say, since Trump was elected, though, I've probably paid less attention to the news for a little bit, just because
you're better off.
Just so tuned upward, it's a bit intense.
Gosh, yes, yeah. Well, I read the AP, which is kind of straight, relatively straight, and then I must say I rely on Twitter and get a lot of stuff from that. I read the New York Times obits. I can't give them up. I read them on my phone at night. I know it sounds macabre. I just love the life stories.
Okay.
I'm sorry they're gone. I just love the life stories. And I have this in common with the late Robert Bork. I once did a piece on people who had, well, about the New York Times. Are people still reading it, or are they giving it up? And he said he couldn't give up the obits. He loved reading them. I do too. And I guess my general view of the Times has changed, the New York Times. I spent so many years complaining about it, even as I read it and learned from it. And Bill Buckley, my old boss and friend, once said that going without the New York Times would be like going without arms and legs. That was a prelude to some criticism he made of the Times. And so I spent so many years being sort of worked up by it, by its liberal bias. Now, I guess I view it as far and away the greatest newspaper in the English language. It's not even a close second place, with a liberal bias, a pronounced political bias. And so I think a lot of us open the New York Times and say, let's see what I hate. Let's see what I'm going to hate and fume about. I treat it now as a kind of menu with 200 items on it, right? And I order what I like. And there's a lot of fantastic foreign correspondence, for example, mm-hmm. and cultural pieces. And I learn a lot about the world from that newspaper. And the other things, I now let go. I was interested to hear Jay say he read the editorials. I haven't read the New York Times editorials in years. I feel I know what they're going to say, but you're probably good due diligence, Jay, to as a journalist to do that. I guess I now treat it as a menu. And it's, you know, I like macaroni and cheese and milkshakes and stuff like that. And that's what I order from the New York Times.
Yeah. And it's funny. I love the New York Times as well. You know, we have the paper edition at the office, which is great.
You have that in common with Bill Buckley. There was nothing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jay.
No, it's okay.
I just want you to know that he got intense pleasure out of reading the New York Times for between an hour and 2 hours every day of his life.
Yeah, and I there's some of the writers there that I greatly respect, people like Nick Confessori, and I think Michael Schmidt is probably one of the best investigative reporters in the country.
Oh my goodness,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, and everybody who complains about the Trump stuff, I remind them, you know, he's the one who broke the Hillary email story. So, you know, he's a good reporter. He's not somebody that has an agenda. He's just a darn good reporter, and I've learned that a lot more since kind of breaking into this business full time, is that, you know, this whole idea that I still think that a lot of writers probably have their own biases that may come out in their writing from time to time. You're going to see that, and that happens with conservative writers as well. So we can't just sit there and point fingers at those who may be, you know, left of center. But overall, when it was funny because I made this point, believe it or not, at a forum, you know, we were on a panel here several months ago that was the audience was largely pro-Trump people, a Salem panel. And I mentioned the New York Times and I heard these groans and I said, you know, you have to judge, you know, what you're reading by what you're reading in the moment. Don't sit there and dismiss it simply because it comes from a source that you don't like, because sooner or later that same source is going to produce something that you agree with or that fits your, you know, the narrative that you like, and you're going to look a little foolish by citing it after you've done nothing but trash it for the entire time. So I like to read it. I especially love the Sunday Times, you know, the Sunday New York Times and the Saturday Wall Street Journal, which has, you know, so many more, you know, inserts and, you know, culture items and things of that nature. It's really nice to actually kind of, you know, I guess it makes me old fashioned, you know, it's there at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee, reading an actual newspaper instead of, you know,
what is that thing you're holding?
That's the most conservative thing I've heard all day, Jay, what you just said. That's so conservative.
So
you may even have a white picket fence for all I know. I love it.
Amy even mentioned, you know, she mentioned a couple of magazines that I'd forgotten, like, you know, the New York Magazine and Vanity Fair and the New Yorker. I mean, some of that stuff, even
they sometimes have great long pieces I just really like.
Yeah.
Even Amy, did you read that piece today in Vanity Fair? I think it came out on the internet today about sort of the last days of Harvey Weinstein. And as he prepared for the appearance of the speaking with the New York Times breaks, that New York Times story.
I favored it because it said something about like he holed up in a hotel and like his main goal was to find out who like outed him.
That's
basically
the thing.
And I was like, oh, I'll read this later. And I didn't put it. I was like, I got the gist of it.
Read the thing like candy. I mean, I'm sort of ashamed of it. But I mean, I just read that thing with as the British people say, with my eyes on stalks. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
Prurient as hell, but still.
Well, you know, as much as people sit there and say journalism is dead, I don't think it is. I think it's obviously contracted.
It's a golden age.
But yeah, I think there's some terrific, there's always something good to read every day. You know, I'll sit there and give a shout out to my colleagues at the Dallas Morning News. And Jay, I don't know if you know this, but we just hired a new editorial page editor. You may know the name. Brendan Miniter is going to take over at the beginning
Terrific.
Of February. What's
Terrific.
That? Yeah, it is. We're excited. You know, people are excited. Kevin Willey, who was the editorial page editor for the last 15 years and just fantastic, you know, at her job and just a wonderful person. I say that too, not just because she hired me, but still, yeah, she's still a great person, but we're kind of looking forward to this new step. And so, you know, there was some of our investigative journalists had there was a psychiatric hospital in the Dallas area where, you know, they uncovered some really ugly stuff to the point where the hospital just announced that they're going to, it's a psychiatric hospital, they announced they're closing. They're just going to shut their doors simply because they know they can't continue operations based upon the stuff that, you know, our reporters had dug up. And I mean, and that's a testament to the kind of hard work that people are still willing to do, the kind of digging. You know, I always point back to, you know, that scene in All the President's Men where they're going through the slips, you know, the request slips. You know, and that's the kind of dogged, you know, kind of investigative journalism that doesn't, you know, that people, that still goes on. People just don't think that it does. They think they're just out there just writing whatever they want, but that's not the way it is. So,
Jay, I remember being in Dallas a couple of years ago, and I paused outside the building of the newspaper, and I read those words by, I believe, Dealey on the building.
Yes.
About a kind of journalistic credo or motto.
Right.
And I can't recite it, but I loved it. Was so old fashioned.
Yeah, it was
about what a newspaper owes to its readers.
Right. Yeah, and it was, you know, we actually just moved out of that building.
Ah.
Yeah, we just moved into a new building that is, you know, it's typical of, you know, what newspapers have gone through. We went from, I think, you know, 325,000 square feet to 90,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and with a bigger emphasis on digital, which is necessary, but there's still great reporting coming out of there. And, you know, I think our editorial team works very hard. I think people have a sense of, you know, newspaper people being kind of lazy and kind of sitting around. And it's like, we're interviewing 260 candidates for primary races between now and the end of, or now the beginning of February. So, it's, you know, everybody's working hard, and, you know, for me, and Jay, you don't know too much of my background, but I was in the corporate world for 20 years before I moved to the journalism side. And so this is still kind of relatively new to me. But people work hard and they want to do, and, you know, and this is the thing, it sounds kind of like flowery and everything, but journalists want to do a good job. They want to get the news out there. It's not about, you know, everybody thinks that every writer has some kind of agenda, but it's really not. It's more about digging into something and reporting it the best that they can.
Well, I think that people, especially men named Caruso, should sing.
No relation. I've been asked that question a number of times. You know, Enrico, is it? No, sorry. I'm not going to break out into song here. And
The man with the longest career at the Met, the Metropolitan Opera, and I was sitting three blocks from it, he was a tenor named Charles Anthony, but his original name was Caruso, and he changed it so as not to have the comparison.
Oh, okay.
Too weird.
Yeah.
But that was his birth name.
I can imagine.
Yeah. He called himself Charles Anthony later. Well, it's a great and historic name.
Well, okay. So, Jay, you know, it's funny. I told you that we would need you for about maybe 30, 40 minutes. We've been talking for an hour. So, and it's been
Sorry
great.
About that.
No, it's been terrific. You know, Amy was concerned we were going to be going into like these little tiny niggling details about Donald Trump's presidency, and I think she's been pleasantly surprised that we kind of we covered enough of it. But I think
I told you I was like I'm not sure I can sit through a year of presidency. I'm glad it went this way.
Yeah, no, it's great, Jay. You were terrific. You know,
well, thank you. I'm glad you're wrapping up, because I was going to tell you guys, I was going to say the most conservative thing that's been said all night. I could say, I have to go to bed, dear ones. I just, I'm not hip like you all. It's,
No. Believe me, I want to go to sleep too. You know, I want to do the same thing. So, no, Jay Nordlinger from National Review, thank you so much. This was a great, great show.
Pleasant. Such a highlight. Thank you so much. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, I'm going to tweet at Jonah Goldberg tomorrow. I'm going to say, you know, just so you know, Jay was a better guest than you. Just so,
uh-oh.
You know.
Listen.
Just get a fight going.
Twitter war? Fine. Just leave my name out of it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll do that. All right. Jay Nordlinger, thank you so much again for being on the Fifth Estate. Really appreciate it. Hopefully you'll come back sometime, right?
I'd love to. Thanks to both of you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Good night. Okay, Amy. So that was we've gone an hour now. I didn't even realize that we were recording that long. You're still there?
Oh, yep. Yeah, I'm still here.
So
like it's better myself now. It's much later for Jay, or the other Jay, not
for the other Jay. Well, it's still 11 o'clock here, and
I'm still. I'm old and tired now too. So,
yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those things. It's you know, you still have you have young kids, so it's like you're still doing. You know, and I can always cut this out if you want me. I'm just saying that Amy's like, you know, still doing the full time job. You know, got young kids kind of thing. So she's, you know, she's better than everybody else. I've got, you know, my kids are 20, 21. You know, they sleep all day. I don't have to worry about them anymore. You know, it's kind of like, all right, you know. It's just like they go to work and do whatever, and I don't have to do anything.
That's kind of nice. I'm not there.
It'll happen. It'll happen. Yeah. But you haven't even gone through you're still at the easy stage. You know, my daughter between the ages of 13 and like 16, I wanted to strangle her pretty much every day. And then boom, she's like all of a sudden was a young lady, and my son was then just a real pain in the ass, still is, and he's almost 21, whereas the girls are, you know, it's true, they are just that much more mature than men. I you know, if you're a parent, you'll see it in your kids. The science is settled.
Yeah, I don't know, the 9-year-old, she's already in that zone, it feels like.
Oh man. Wow.
I think if the infection starts sooner, I don't know.
Oh boy. We'll just have to, we'll keep you in our prayers to make sure that, you know, it just everything goes all right. Okay. All right, Amy. So that was fun. You know, sooner or later, we're going to have to come up with something that we did, like Neil and I did, some kind of, you know, question or something that we disagree on, and kind of feed it to our guests and kind of keep tally of that. It'll be fun.
We'll have to think of one.
Yeah, I have to figure it out, you know, because I don't know. You and I probably agree a little bit more than Neil and I did on certain things. So maybe it's something else. We'll figure
Neil
something
out. Neil loved to have contempt for irrational things like Seinfeld or... and then
yeah, exactly.
So it's different.
Yeah.
There's always the Star Trek, Star Wars, but you guys have done that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we can freshen it up. We can do something else. We'll see. We'll see. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Fifth Estate. For Amy Otto, I'm Jay Caruso. We will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.